So this week, in thinking about what to talk about this evening, for some reason I was motivated or had the interest to talk about one of the most challenging teachings. Most people find it quite challenging, that teaching, the teaching of anatta, or not self. And it's not one that we often launch into in just a weekly drop-in class. It takes a little consideration and practice to truly understand what the Buddha was pointing to, but it's so central to the Buddha's teachings that it's useful to have the conversation, and hopefully we can have a conversation about what was it the Buddha was talking about. So hopefully a little interactive this evening, and also time for questions and a conversation at the end. But we've also been going over this theme in a program that I'm leading at the moment, the Advanced Practitioner Program out at Spirit Rock, where we're looking at different aspects of emptiness, of shunyata. And anatta is a very central aspect of the teachings of emptiness, of conditionality. And I won't get into those, but this is a central one. And so the Buddha spoke about it a lot. It was central to his teaching of the three characteristics, if you know that, as a very central teaching of impermanence, unsatisfactoriness, and not self. He said these are the hallmarks of conditioned existence. So it's right there in that list. And every teaching, including the Satipatthana Sutta, which is the teaching on the four foundations of mindfulness that forms the basis of our meditation practice, in what's called the refrain or the insight section of that teaching, always pointing to that not to hold this as I, me, or mine. So very central. But this evening, I want to talk really about why is this relevant? Why is it useful? Why did the Buddha teach this? And what's useful here and now about it? But also start from this quote that I've always thought was on point by Jack Angler. He's a psychotherapist who's a meditation practitioner. I think he coined this phrase, I don't know, 30 years ago, 40 years ago, true then, I think it's true today. His phrase is, you have to be somebody before you can be nobody. And what that is pointing to is you can't just preempt or launch into or try to grasp a hold of these teachings on emptiness and anatta, not self, until you really understand the self and how it's created, and basically have a healthy sense of self. That to try and ignore that necessary process can lead to all kinds of misunderstandings, confusion, and delusion, really. It can be not helpful. So this is the angle that I want to approach these teachings on tonight, holding that phrase in mind. You've got to be somebody before you can be nobody. And I was sitting in meditation yesterday at my house. I live in a house that's surrounded by trees. It's in a forest, and I sometimes keep my eyes open in meditation. I have a very spacious view where I sit, and it was very still and peaceful. But then I heard this loud noise, a whooshing, rolling kind of noise, and, I had my eyes open. It was still, the room was still, the trees were still, but definite noise. So I looked a little further, and I could see in the distant trees, they were really rolling with the wind. And so it was just one of those moments where I really got to see the wind approaching. I could hear it, I could see it in the distance, and then, it could track as it moved from tree to tree and then came right up to close to where I was sitting. And it just, as I was doing that, I was like, oh, it's windy. That's what we'd say, right? It's windy. But are we actually seeing the wind? No, right? What are we seeing? The effects of the wind. The effects of the wind. The trees moving. The wind, and I was trying to think, what is the wind? It's air, I guess. Is that what it is? Moving in response to different pressure gradients. But it's invisible, right? It's just this movement that you can perhaps feel on your face, but when you're just looking at it, you don't see it. You see the effects. And it's much the same way that we relate to the self. we think there's something there, but we're just seeing the effects of what the Buddha called selfing, or grasping, identifying with, and he would particularly talk about this in relationship to the five aggregates. Again, I've said this before, if you know anything about Buddhism, he liked bliss. I've already mentioned a few, the five aggregates. I think someone gave a teaching on the five aggregates here a few weeks ago, right? So you're all old hands, you know exactly what I'm talking about, the five aggregates. Form, the body, feeling, tone, vedana, perception, the way we name and understand the world, sankharas, mental formations, and consciousness, vijnana. He said, this is what you cling to and identify with, and around those five, we create this sense of self. But most of the time, just like the wind, we think there's something there because there's this process happening that feels very real. The wind, when it's moving the trees, you know, there's something happening, but it's not what we think it is, and that's where we get confused. But it's really important to remember that the Buddha actually, in this teaching, didn't say there's no self, right? You'll hear me, and hopefully I'll remember to do this every time, is to say not self, not in the five aggregates, not in the six sense bases. Anywhere you look, you might see the signs or this sort of idea of self, but you can't actually find it. So there's this classic sutta where the Buddha is in a dialogue with Vajragupta. He's a wanderer, so not a student of the Buddha's, and he's directly asked the Buddha, is there a self? And the Buddha, as he would sometimes do, he stayed silent. He didn't answer. And of course, it says this Vajragupta, the wanderer, you know, got quite huffy and said, well, and stomped off. And so Ananda, the Buddha's disciple, who was definitely a student of his and quite understood the teachings, said, why didn't you answer him? He was right there. You could have given him a direct answer. So this is what the Buddha said. Ananda, if I, being asked by Vajragupta, the wanderer, if there is a self, were to answer that there is a self, that would be conforming with those Brahmins and contemplatives who are exponents of eternalism, the view that there's an eternal, unchanging soul. And that was the idea of atta. And if you know anything about the religions of the time, there was a strong belief in atta, which is kind of equivalent to a soul. It was some energy that each human being contained, and the idea was you release the atta and it came into union with the Brahma, the creator energy. So it was this sense you had to get released, transcend the body, and the atta would be released, and that would be freedom or liberation. That was the high point. So that was one view. And so the Buddha said, no, anatta. And an just means not atta, not permanent, not soul. Goes on to say, if I, being asked by Vajragupta, the wanderer, if there is no self, were to answer that there is no self, then that would be conforming with those Brahmins and contemplatives who are exponents of annihilationism, the view that death is the annihilation of consciousness. If I, being asked by Vajragupta, were to answer that there is a self, would that be in keeping with the arising of knowledge that all phenomena are not self, which is what the Buddha actually says? All phenomena are not self. And Ananda, as I said, knows the teaching, says, no, Lord. And then the Buddha says, and if I, being asked by Vajragupta, the wanderer, if there is no self, were to answer that there is no self, the bewildered Vajragupta would then become even more bewildered. That does the self I used to have now not exist? And this is, I mean, from 2,600 years ago, it's a dialogue almost word for word you could have sometimes with people today, because when they hear this teaching, they think that there's something there, a self, that Buddhism says you have to get rid of. And that's not what the Buddha's saying. He's saying phenomena are not self, the aggregates are not self. There is nothing permanent, lasting, abiding that can be a source of happiness that we're in control of, that's at the center of things. It's just this arising, passing flow of experience. So again and again, he said, all phenomena any aspect of experience and not self. Look and see. And that's what he would always say. You know, if you can show it to me, great, I'll change my mind. But so far, haven't found it. And even neuroscientists today, I'm hearing a kind of agreeing. You know, there's just this these processes happening. We solidify it through our thoughts and concepts, but that's not actually what's happening. And so the common lens that the Buddha would talk about is through, as I said, the five aggregates. And he'd say, this look, if you want to understand what I'm talking about, look in these five areas, because you'll see that's where you identify as self, that's where you cling and hold on, want to control, and that's what causes your suffering. Because that's what this teaching comes down to. When I said looking at why is it relevant, the Buddha wasn't doing it as a speculative view, a philosophical tenet, you know, this I think, therefore I am kind of thing. His teachings, as he said again and again, were about suffering and the end of suffering. So any teaching that you hear of the Buddha's, you have to look in that framework. How is it pointing to how we create suffering, and how is it pointing to how we can reduce and eventually end suffering? This teaching is central to that. So he would often say, just like with the question from Vajragada, he wouldn't answer. He'd say, that's not relevant. You know, is the cosmos, you know, beginning or ending? Is it large or small? What is there a self or not? As they say, not relevant to what I'm interested in, which is helping you find freedom, liberation, ease, peace, whatever, you know, however you might view that. He would always come back to that. And so there's a whole, you can read a lot about the Buddha and skill in questions, you know, what questions should be answered, not answered, reframed, or, you know, directly answered. He's always, question and answer is a strong teaching paradigm for him. So he says, look and see. His lens was through the five aggregates, but if you're not, well, you might not be familiar with that as a framework, but in essence, it's saying body and mind. Adds awareness, a consciousness, which is a little more subtle, but most of us, I think, can relate to how we identify with our bodies as being who we are, or our mind, thoughts, and emotions, memories being who we are. That's a kind of shorthand for the aggregates. It's very straightforward in that way. And people on the street, you know, who haven't encountered these teachings, this is how they relate. You know, my body, my thoughts, my emotions, and there's a sense of that's who I am. So just to ask you, if you've thought about this at all, these teachings on self and not self, what is your experience like when the sense of self is strong? Are you familiar with being curious about that? When the sense of self is strong, what are some common aspects of that experience?
When I'm angry.
When you're angry.
Self is really strong. I'm right.
Strong emotion and identification with emotion, and a huge one is self-righteous indignation, variations of I'm right, if only they did, they should listen, why didn't they? What's that experience actually like? So there's the anger, and that, you know, that can have often an unpleasantness, but it can have an energy by it, around it. But can you separate out that piece, the I am X? Does that have a particular...
It's large and it's very exclusive. It kind of puts your blinders
on. Yeah, so there's a kind of barrier that gets created, right, between self and other. Anything physical about it?
Heat. A lot of energy,
yeah. Haven't said anything too pleasant about it yet. I'll just note that.
Yeah,
Phil. Oh, sorry.
I'm when I want something,
mm-hmm.
because I'm so deserving.
Mm, so deserving, yes.
And it's unpleasant.
Unpleasant. And so interesting, you went with anger, you went with the want. These are our classic polarities, right? Wanting, not wanting, self-arising. Deborah.
Well, I was afraid to go first because I also wanted to say anger.
Mm-hmm.
But when you first posed the question, the word aversion came up. Mm. It's that feeling of the feeling in my body is contraction.
Mm-hmm. Contraction.
Contraction.
Yes.
Especially in my throat.
Yes.
Also in my heart and section. So, and that's very what Linda was saying. You know, walling
yes.
others away.
Yes. Yes.
Which then walls me away.
Yes.
And the self-righteous indignation.
Yes.
But woven in there for me too is what triggers the anger oftentimes is this concept maybe
mm-hmm.
of injustice, inequality.
Mm-hmm.
That's a real trigger.
Yeah, sure. And you know, as we started the evening, there is huge injustice in the world. It's not that we shouldn't take note of that and act, but that, you know, we just have to see how effective is that, and is that creating or lessening suffering, inner and outer? And, you know, again, that's a complicated field, but I want to keep pointing to kind of the sort of essential aspects, and you've said a few things, burning heat, contraction is a big one, contraction and barrier separation. This is a really common experience.
When I'm projecting myself in the past and future.
Projecting past and future, yeah. So there's often a lot of concept around
yes,
it.
Yes, very much so.
Me, then, me, you know, and we, you know, the...
Comparing
mind in the sort of film scenario where, you know, all the spotlight's on us and we're here and now we're there and we're like this and not like that. Yeah, but what's that felt sense there?
It's also a contracted.
Contracted.
Feeling. Yeah, sometimes it's sinking.
Sinking, heavy.
It's usually negative.
Negative, yeah.
Even if it starts out positive, the negative has to
work. It's interesting, isn't it? Because the reason that we've trained ourselves to do this is we got something out of it. It served us, right? You know, we learnt to be a self. And when we were born, as far as I know, you know, babies are kind of, you know, in the womb undifferentiated. They come out, they're not very differentiated. I kind of have to learn, oh, that... When I do that, that hurts me, you know, and, oh, I can use this hand to get something, and they start interacting with the world. So we learn how to do this because it's useful. But like so much of what we do in our minds and hearts, it gets distorted by neuroses, by fear, by trauma, by the experiences of life, and this solidification happens. This is what the Buddha wanted us to look at.
When this is such a complex subject,
mm-hmm.
and I've contemplated, you know, what does this really mean?
Mm-hmm.
And for me, it's a difficult thing to separate mythology, family. I'm talking strictly about family.
Oh, uh-huh.
Family mythology mm-hmm. and reality, and conditioning now.
Mm-hmm.
And if I had to say that there's no self, then that means that nothing in my family ever existed and nothing ever will exist. And so it's that mythology, it's hard for me to grasp.
Well, as I said, I never say there's no self.
I understand that.
Yeah.
But see, the conflict is, what does this all mean?
It means that when you hold on to an identification, just as people say,
mm-hmm.
You know, sometimes it's a successful strategy and we get what we want, but that's often pretty fleeting. It just means, basically the Buddha would say it means we suffer. Whether it's our family conditioning or in the very individual conditioning, whether it's societal, you know, views of who we are, our sexuality or our gender or our race. Yeah, that's, let me talk about it and see where we get to with this. So let's go on, because... Yeah.
I just wanted to ask, because I've heard it said, if I don't have my memories, who am I?
Uh-huh. So, yeah, but if I don't have my memories, there's nothing saying here that you have to... It's not a lobotomy. It's just saying, you know, as people say, if you identify and hold on to fixed views, view of self, view of other, there is going to be suffering. It might be very subtle suffering from unreliability. It's nothing about getting rid of memories. And that's what I want to talk about. Is that you have to be somebody with memories and conditioning and family, before you can be nobody. This is what I want to talk about tonight. Because, as I said, people often get the view that it's about getting rid of something. Have you seen, and I was hesitant about bringing this into the room, but it's not political per se, but it's a meme that's going around at the moment, especially, you know, my kind of friends send it around. It's a Buddhist monk image with the Trump head put on it. Have you seen this one? And the quote is, "People love me because I've transcended my ego. I transcend egos better than anyone else. You've never met anyone who has transcended the ego better than me." And what, you know, why this is funny is because there's actually some truth. People can get competitive about getting rid of the, you know, my not-self is smaller than your not-self. You know, or that, you know, there's some race here. And what that can lead to is a sense of spiritual bypass, as I said, where they're not actually working with in a skillful way their family conditioning, their memories, their past. All, you know, as you know, when we meditate, all of this has to be included in a skillful way so we really start to understand what's going on here. So we talked a little bit about what the self is like and, you know, brought up difficult experiences, but when things are beautiful, when things are going well, you know, I was trying to think of how to point to this, and I don't know whether this will work to you. I thought, so we're having a pleasant experience, whatever it is, sensual in some way, could be out in nature, and I thought, for me, the two different ways I could name this experience, oh, this is lovely, or I'm really enjoying this. Which one do you think actually allows us to more connect with the pleasantness or the beauty of what's happening? This is lovely. Because it just says this is how it... You know, most of the time, if something is real, if you're having sex or something really... You don't say, I'm really enjoying this. You know, you really want to be in the moment. Because why? If the I is there in that strong way, what happens? It kind of takes you out or objectifies, it removes you from the actual experience. And so people talk, you know, when you're being creative or in sports, people talk about being in the zone. You know, if there's a lot of thinking or selfing in those kind of activities, even being out in nature, as I said, you lose the actual immediacy and openness. I came back from a trip where we visited the Grand Canyon, and it's just, it is breathtaking. And the worst thing is the people who are there recording it and narrating to themselves as they're, you know, and you're kind of, please, can I just stand here and be awestruck instead of listening to your narration of what's going on in front of you? It's, that isn't actually being fully present. But what we start to see as we look is this process that's happening all the time. We think of it as a noun, self, you know, the self with a capital S, me. It's a verb. It's something that we do. We talk about selfing. And when we start to see it like that, it's a little more understandable what's happening and why it's always arising. But it also gives us a more of a sense of agency. It is something that we're doing in a way, that we're almost choosing to do. And we're constantly doing it. And I liked Andy Olensky. He's a scholar, Buddhist scholar, who does a lot of teaching at the BCBS, Barry Center for Buddhist Studies. Usually we think, and he was talking about grasping tanha, which the Buddha said, second noble truth, cause of suffering. Usually we think, oh, I grasp to get what I want, right? Self-grasping. He says, what becomes clear through this analysis of moment-to-moment experience, basically being mindful, especially intensive practice, is that grasping is not something done by the self, but rather self is something done by grasping. The self is constructed each moment for the simple purpose of providing the one who likes or doesn't like, holds on to or pushes away what is unfolding in experience. And I just like that because it puts a different spin, that the tanha, the grasping, this primal urge, and as you know, probably know, grasping includes the pushing away, because even when you want to push something away, you have to contact it somehow. It includes a desire and aversion. That's so primal that we create a self to what's the word he uses? To provide the one who likes and doesn't like. The urging is there, but the urging, if you really pay attention, can happen in a very selfless kind of way. So again, whether you believe that or not, it just kind of puts a different spin on what we're talking about here. And I was at a retreat a little while ago talking to an artist who, you know, in the creative process is very free and, you know, intuitive, and the mind is just quiet but has this vibrancy to it. She loves that process. She hates showing people her work, you know, having an opening or, you know, the gallery, what do you call it, the
exhibition.
And she said there she's contracted and she's fearful and she's looking at people to see how they're relating, what do they think. And I said, isn't that suffering? And she said, yes, it's horrible. I said, why can't you relate the same to the people in the gallery as you do to the blank canvas? That same sense of flow and openness and not in control. And it was like a revelation to think she could practice with that and see, you know, bring that same sense of not being constricted, not having to be judged or identified with her work that she does when she's actually in the creative process. It was a huge revelation to that. So this is what the Buddha is talking about when, as we were pointing to, when we really hold on to the sense of self, it's often as a strategy to get something, to avoid something, that to, you know, our views and opinions, our likes and our dislikes. We really need to see how much dukkha there is around that. That's his teaching. It's like, look and see what it's like. Don't just go with the flow and not question. Go with the, you know, standard conditioning. Actually take a look at what's happening here. But at the same time, as I said, to be somebody means that we don't want to use these teachings to deny our conditioning, our gender, our race, our sexuality, whatever it is that has shaped us. The one does not deny the other. It's not about, or only about, you know, that's not relevant or not important. There's a wonderful book by Zenju Earthland Manuel, who I think teaches over at EBMC, East Bay Meditation Center, called The Way of Tenderness. And it's a beautiful approach to this, a lot around the teachings of anatta and emptiness, but related to who we are as human beings. And she said that she had a lot of pain and confusion because her Zen teachers would tell her, basically, to deny or transcend her experience as an African-American bisexual woman. You know, oh, you have to let that go. That's not relevant here. But she had a huge amount of pain around that those identities in relationship to cultural oppression that she'd felt. You know, but they said, if you want to be liberated, you have to get beyond that. And that, as I said, just leads to spiritual bypass. It's not helpful. Nagarjuna, the great teacher of emptiness, would talk about one-legged emptiness, where we try to hold on to the transcendent without integrating and understanding the very real relative of our sexuality or our race or our conditioning, our trauma, our fears. And so for many of us, that's an important part of our spiritual practice on retreat in our lives. I just read this beautiful article by Ajahn Suchito, who's one of my teachers. I respect him so much. And he called it Skin, Heart, and Person. He's got a blog, so you could find it if you want to look. And I just, there's an excerpt from it. I'll read. With the aim of bringing around the release from suffering, Dharma practice often emphasizes letting go of the personal. That is, if we put aside the clutter of our everyday events, we can go deeply inwards and access transcendent freedom. In this transpersonal ultimate truth, we go by beyond identity with all its issues. Here, one's wrappings don't pertain and one can feel free. However, emphasis on the transpersonal alone skips or trivializes how we arise in the interactive world of other people and social responsibilities. People with second-rate wrappings are particularly let down by ultimate truth, having been advised that personal issues are a mere convention and to be abandoned in the spiritual quest. They experience shame about still having any. Truth is above, this is a quote, truth is above race, appearance, and social position. They shouldn't mean anything to me. And it's easy enough, maybe, to not take one's social position personally when you're white, male, and middle class. And even for those who can deepen into transpersonal depth at a meditation retreat, there remains the issue of the personal and social domain. If one leaves the retreat skinless, how do we meet the world with its get-ahead messages and performance drives? How do we integrate the Dharma into an individual and interactive life? We'll probably just grab the nearest set of wrappings, those of a slightly improved and more ethically attuned self, and return to the old attitudes, anxieties, and self-image. It is the nature of the person pack, Sakaya, but to transcend this, one has to reveal and resolve personal issues at their basis rather than get over them. No transcendence without personal inclusion, that's a quote, is a useful motto. Consequently, in the fulfillment of Dharma practice, depths and surface have to both be respected. The clarity and resources of the transpersonal have to embrace and address the issues of the personal so that we can wear, lightly but clearly, a skin that fits our own hearts. And I just like that line. We can wear lightly but clearly, as in, you know, not making that solid or any more real than anything else, a skin that fits our heart, that matches, you know, our conditioning and who we are. But we can start to understand that process. So this is what I mean by having a healthy sense of self. Not to use these teachings to deny the importance, the value of that work, of the healing and understanding that we can bring to our conditioning. And as much as the Buddha talked about the perception of not self, that all phenomena are not self, he would also talk about the perception of self as skillful. This is from the Dhammapada. Your own self is your mainstay, for who else could your mainstay be? With you yourself well trained, you obtain a mainstay hard to obtain. Basically saying, let's work on this sense of self so it's reliable and trustworthy and you can use it on the path. That's the point. So we start to learn to relate to ourselves with kindness and wisdom, understanding. And there's a huge amount of healing that is necessary for most of us to, again, understand the shaping of our cultural conditioning, our family conditioning, and it's the heart of our metta practice. You know, may I be well. May I live with ease. May I be strong and healthy. May I be happy. The Buddha said this is essential. You know, this classic teaching that we often quote around metta said, and this is from the Udana, searching all directions with one's awareness, one finds no one dearer to oneself than oneself. In the same way others are to themselves fiercely dear, so one should not hurt others if one loves oneself. So just this sense of the connection, you know, for every person, they are dear to themselves. And so we hold that as a truth and do this deep work of healing and understanding, forgiveness, forgiveness of ourselves, forgiveness of others, that can lead to compassion, lead to equanimity, and the whole path of practice can deepen out of that kind of transformation. But again, if you know the Buddha's teachings on metta, at the end of the Metta Sutta, where he describes his practice of wishing in gladness and in safety, may all beings be at ease, it ends with, by not holding to fixed views, the pure-hearted one, having clarity of vision, is not born again into this world. And you could do a whole discourse just on those four lines, but having clarity of vision means seeing with wisdom, not holding on to a sense of self, freed from all sense desire, so that force of tanha, grasping, has gone, there's the possibility of real freedom. That's the culmination, that's the fruition of metta practice. Starting from wishing oneself to be at ease and happy and joyful and healthy and strong, it ends in that place. And it's kind of, that's the trajectory of our practice. We start with the healing and the well-wishing and the understanding of how we got to be where we are. As Ajahn Sumedho would say, you have to know self to know not self. We have to understand how this self has been shaped and created, but we also have to know what it's not, or how to let it go. It's like having a really trustworthy car, you know, one you get into and you start it up and it always starts, doesn't matter how long you've been away or what the weather is, but you don't bring the car inside the hall with you, right? You know when to turn it off and walk away and let it go. It's the same, you know? So we start to see this process of selfing. We train and understand this process so that it's supportive of our practice, and then we know when to let it go. So again, from Ajahn Sucitto, that article, such psychological skin forms boundaries around what I will take in and what I will not accept in terms of the behavior of others. It respects personal privacy, and it gives us the right to choose the time and place to open up or not. Instead of feeling defined by the projections of others or defining others in terms of one's own projections, we can feel a safe and intimate somatic domain and not get thrown out into such views. But through knowing the refuge, and he uses a capital R, and he's talking about refuge in mindfulness, Buddha Dhamma Sangha, we know that we're not what we're not. And through integrating that into our individuality, we know how to relate to that with clarity, groundedness, and empathy, of course. So they're not separate, and they shouldn't be separate. Each has a function, self and not self. And again, Thanissaro Bhikkhu has a great article on this kind of theme called the not-self strategy. And this is what he says. Because the path to awakening leads to a total happiness, the need to think in terms of self and not self ends when the path reaches its goal. And because the path is a set of actions leading to the end of action, all aspects of the path, including perceptions of self and not self, are strategies. And I like that, a strategy. You know, he'll go on to say it. Strategies, actions adopted to serve a purpose and then put aside when that purpose is served. Although an awakened person can still use these perceptions for strategic purposes when dealing with others, the fact that they are perceptions and thus included under the aggregates mean that they are transcended in the plunge into unbinding, basically into freedom. And that, of course, is what the Buddha says. Whether it's true, that is useful in putting an end to suffering, cannot be proved simply by quoting. He has a whole thing about how people take particularly this dialogue with Vacchagatha to mean, you know, this or that about the Buddha's teachings. Cannot be proved simply by quoting certain aspects of the Buddha's teachings. The ultimate test of this interpretation is to put it into practice and see if it actually leads to the aim of the Buddha's teachings, the total end of suffering. So a few key points there. You know that this self has a reality, but just like any verb, like the wind, it's a strategy. If we bring that into consciousness, we have a choice. How do we use that strategy of self? When is it a useful designation? Sally, Deborah, Bill, whatever. Very useful strategies. And when is that an obstacle? When do we, you know, and what we see is, oh, it's when we hold on to it, when we contract around it, when it becomes a barrier to actual presence, as I was talking about before. My watch it anyway. When we look at it in that way, there's so much more fluidity and freedom in this. We're not bound by views and opinions, projections, ours or other people. We all have views and opinions about who we are. We're affected by the projections of others, but we see all that as process. When we understand that, there's a different way to relate to this whole question. So, I know that's a lot to take in. As I said, it's not an easy topic, and it's not something that you get to by tussling with and thinking about. This is really key. The self doesn't let go of the self. You can't decide that I'm going to have a not self today. But it's only through inquiry into what is it like when I identify with these aspects of my experience, when we start to look at this in a very real time, and especially when the mind is more quiet, we're in the busyness of our lives and things are happening, hard to see, but you can see, you know, the moments of anger or identification or separation, self-righteous indignation. Feel that. Feel what's happening. When you're in nature and it's beautiful, as I said, I tried to think of two quotes, you know, just to say, oh, isn't this beautiful? Or, oh, I love this. How can I get a photo of this, take this home? I want this view, you know. Feel what that's like energetically. So what for you has been ways, again, now that we've had a bit of a discussion, you notice self, and what are your strategies for self and not self? When is self useful? When is it not useful? How do you know when selfing is happening? What are the signs?
Yeah. Just simply sitting listening to a Dharma talk, and comfortably, even when you ask the question, you know, self is now, self is this, I'm here, my body, this is my breath, this is me. Not even a question. It's just me. And it's me now, quite simply.
But, you know, because, again, breath, body, it's what our meditation is. The it's me is extra, right?
Yeah.
Because the first thing, oh, breath, body, sitting here, yeah. But that's me.
Yeah.
Isn't that extra?
Yes.
Yeah. And, again, not to say that we don't do that. We do. But just to know that we do. And to know that it's extra. And that's one of the interesting things. And again, if you've been on a retreat and the mind has gotten quiet, you've seen how little you actually need to add that that's me and mine and I need to be able to move through your day. You know? Yeah. This time, Deborah first.
So if I understood your question, when I catch myself, if I can remember what my aspiration is and ask myself, what am I doing?
But how do you catch yourself?
Getting old and coming here a lot.
So I think that's more like the trees moving. What's the direct experience of catching yourself?
Well, what I'm aware that, okay, I've gone over these three sentences 25 times, and I'm getting ahead. Doing this, or my throat's tight, or
so there is some, again, we're back to, it's very physical almost, there's a contraction, there's a
I think it's also having set an intention and having
Yes, definitely.
That intention and aspiring, you know, not to be enlightened and never return if we actually return, but just to have a more peaceful day.
Wonderful, yeah.
Just a more relaxed moment.
And what the thing you said that's so key is to have the intention. It's like we arouse the mindfulness. This is something I want to pay attention to. Because in order to, in service of, it's suffering.
Not doing it.
Yes, yes, because that's not suffering. And, you know, or we do it and we see we're doing it, and as Ajahn Suchita says, we hold it lightly. You know, we I love that line. How did he say it again?
Our skin. We're lightly but closely.
The one that suits us or something. I forget.
Lightly but clearly.
Lightly but clearly.
A skin that fits your own arms.
Oh, there it is. So we can wear lightly, thank you. wear lightly but clearly a skin that fits our heart. So, you know, it doesn't deny our memories and who we are. But we see that we're doing that. And, you know, if we can do it lightly, there's not a denial or repression there.
Well, you touched on it already, mm-hmm. but if I find I'm suffering and pay attention to it, it's usually because I'm busy solving.
Exactly. That's, you know, that's the $64,000 neon flashing light. And, you know, this is where the Buddha's teachings are sort of counterintuitive, where he says, go for where it hurts. Where are you, you know, if you're suffering, look at that. Look right there. Don't try and get away from it, replace it with something else, ignore it. Actually look right there. And usually, pretty much all the time, we'll find there's some concept. And, you know, it have layers to it, because at first it might be, oh, no, it's out there, I'm thinking about this. But ultimately, it's views and opinions, sakkaya ditti, personality view.
I don't deserve this. This shouldn't be happening.
Yeah, all of the story, all of the story.
I want that.
Yeah.
I deserve that.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Yes.
Here's where the teaching trips me up a little bit. Mm-hmm. In order to cease selfing, I have to become somebody first, and therefore I have to resolve all my personal issues to heal myself, which is going to take 40 years of deep therapy. It's a long process. I mean,
but that's, I see, that's the radical nature of the Buddha's teachings, is it's not you have to get through. If you see, that's why it's called insight meditation. If you see a pattern clearly enough, people have said, you know, a week of retreat is worth 10 years of therapy, because you see it in this direct, intimate way. It's not mediated through someone else's view, it's not you stewing about it, it's just this immediacy. So, you know, I have this metric, and I don't have no validity or justification for it, whatever, but one moment of mindfulness counteracts 10,000 moments, mind moments of delusion. So I don't know what your metric is then, but it really doesn't have to be. You have to, you know, this path is like A to there, and then you can start the freeing. It happens, as soon as you have one clear recognition, oh, that's why I do that. Or that's why this feels this way. Or that's why that always happens in that situation. It's like, oh, it's right there. So no, I don't think we don't have to wait. There is some unwinding that does need to happen, because we see how deep these patterns go. So it's not to diminish that it can take time, but the freedom that we can feel in even a little bit of unwinding is so valuable that, you know, it's worth continuing. Yeah.
For me, at least in the recent past, mm-hmm. I'm trying to follow the path of consciousness. What am I paying attention
yes.
to?
Yes, yeah, what am I paying attention to?
What am I paying attention uh-huh. to? In this room, there are so many things mm-hmm. I can pay attention to, but I'm not paying attention to them. I'm paying attention talking to you.
Mm-hmm.
But then follow the path of the shifting sense of consciousness
yeah.
in that way. And then sometimes I try and investigate, gee, I wonder why
mm-hmm.
that this path is following mm-hmm. that direction. And mm-hmm. it's sort of, there's some self in there
yeah.
that is following that that stream. Why am I paying attention to you instead of to the Buddha over there? What I mean, I have no clue as to why I'm doing that. But still, that following the stream of what am I paying attention to, and well, it leads me to see that there is the sense of non-self, and in that stream is not controllable.
Right, exactly. Yes. And what, you know, not, is a great, but noticing what you're paying attention to and just seeing all the five aggregates are playing out here, because your perceptions are playing out, you know, what you're noticing, there's intention there, and they're all, if we don't bring mindfulness to it, it's on, as you say, an out of control, not in our control patterning, we're just reacting. We bring mindfulness to it and get curious about it, the whole equation changes, because then you could choose to pay attention to the Buddha or to me. You know, there is more of a sense of agency then, and that's the thing that meditation does, is it allows us to make these choice points where we hopefully can choose out of the wisdom mind rather than the reactive, you know, habitually conditioned mind.
Right.
Yeah. And here at the back.
So I'm trying to get back to the edge of self, and so and non-trust, or distrust. And the deepest safety, good feeling, peace, all of those nice words, is when I don't have any sense of a separate self.
Mm-hmm.
Right? It's a wonderful, blissful feeling. And the edge for me is, and there still needs to be something pulling back from the edge, because the world is not entirely safe place. It's like the old acid thing about merging with traffic. That it's wonderful to be in that non-separate self state. But that's where the edge, the razor edge of self, is maybe helpful.
Yeah.
Sure.
So talking about the can feel into not-self when there's trust and this sense of non-separation, but the world is not a safe place a lot of the time. But we've got to remember that you have as much not-self, as far as the Buddha's concerned, in a blissful pool of liquid love as you do out on the freeway. You know, the same dynamics are there. You know, we can't equate... I had a conversation with a student the other day. She said, emptiness, when I'm empty, you know, it's all open and light. But then I have to go out in the world. It's like we're making a separation there. Yeah, you know, as I said, that there is a reality of interacting and we need to take care and drive safely or whatever. But it doesn't mean there's any more self there unless we're creating it. You know, we are doing that, and we may be doing it out of a habit or of some kind of choice, because that's the only way we know to operate in a world that's not safe. But I always have to go, you know, as far as I know, the Buddha didn't waver in his understanding of the aggregates and how he was relating to them. And he, you know, people tried to kill him and there was all kinds of difficult things happening, but he didn't have to create a self to feel safe. And I'm not saying that we don't. I mean, I think I do. You know, what do I need to do? But as I liked, again, Ajahn Suchito, to wear that lightly, to know we're doing it as a strategy, but it's something that we're doing. That's what the Buddha keeps pointing to, is that it's a strategy, and now we're doing it, and now we're not. And, you know, just to see where the suffering is. I see we're getting towards the end of our time, and I know you have a closing of metta that someone likes to leave, but as I said, I know these are challenging teachings. It's not something you can get. We could probably talk all day or all evening or whatever about this, but really just to come back to the reflection, and I always remind people, as many of you said, we can feel physically the sense of self, you know, that little jolt, that little rising of energy, that little sense of separation, a little tightening of the jaw. Just be with that. That's the start of looking at this. Because that's, as far as I feel, suffering to do that. And when, you know, yes, it's lovely to be, you know, in meditation or peace or bliss, but can we be engaged in the world in a way that doesn't have that sharp edge and contraction? That's our practice. That is a practice.